70% of all women having abortions have some moral conflict, maternal conflict. It's against their values and preferences. For that 70% of the women, guilt, grief, depression, anxiety, shame were all much more common than relief.
Welcome to Straight Talk on Life Issues. It's great to have you with us. I'm Brad Mattis, president of Life Issues Institute.
And I'm your co-host, Victor Nieves. It's a pleasure to be here with you today. Grief after abortion can oftentimes be overwhelming.
And Planned Parenthood claims over 95% of women who've had abortions say they mostly felt relief after their abortion. That number is highly exaggerated. At first, there are some who may feel a sense of relief, but most are likely to carry an overwhelming sense of loss, grief, and shame.
A new study of randomly sampled American women contradicts the claim of Planned Parenthood. Following an abortion, grief is much more common and more intensely felt than relief.
Relief may stem from feelings like you made the best choice given your circumstances, but that doesn't mean feelings of sadness, regret, or confusion won't surface too. And this new report shows much higher levels of guilt, shame, and regret.
And today we're going to talk more about why that's so common with our expert guests. Joining us first is Dr. David Reardon, director of the Elliott Institute and an associate scholar with the Charlotte Lozier Institute. He's widely recognized as one of the leading experts on the after effects of pregnancy loss in women. We're also joined by Mackenzie Jarrell. She's a 25-year-old Navy veteran who served for 4.5 years. Today, she works full-time and leads abortion recovery classes, helping men and women who regret their abortions find hope, healing, and lasting freedom through Jesus.
Dr. Reardon and Mackenzie, thank you for joining us today.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin with you, Mackenzie. Briefly tell us your story.
I was in the military. I joined the Navy when I was 18. And 6 months after I joined the Navy, I decided to get married. I hopped into a physically and emotionally abusive relationship. A year after being in that marriage, I ended up meeting a coworker. We ended up having feelings for each other. I ended up committing adultery with him and I got pregnant. The Navy has a strict no adultery policy and I wasn't sure what was going to happen. I wasn't sure if I would get dishonorably discharged or other than honorably discharged out of the Navy. So I was just terrified. So I decided to go ahead with my first abortion. I felt alone. I was terrified. I went to the abortion clinic and they set me up with the pill abortion. So I went and picked up the abortion pills from my local CVS. I went home and had my first abortion in my bathroom. And it was so traumatizing that I ended up becoming an alcoholic myself. And the Navy, shortly after that, sent me to a level 3 rehab program because my work was suffering so terribly. I couldn't function at all because of the grief and the shame. And I felt like I didn't have anybody to talk to about it. I remained in my marriage. And then the same thing ended up happening again, basically with the same man. Roe versus Wade happening. So I was afraid of, you know, what was I even going to be able to get the abortion? So there was a time limit on it. The same, like the fear, the anxiety, feeling alone, same process. But this time when I went to the clinic, I was intoxicated. So I hardly remember anything with that second abortion. I remember the pain, but as far as like the emotions and everything, it's really blurry. But after my second abortion, I ended up getting out of the Navy. They never found out about it. And I had lost everything. My ex-husband found out about everything. The baby's father ended up leaving me and I moved back home and I was traumatized. I was so broken. I had no hope, depressed. And I had a plan to kill myself on April 26th of 2023. And I cried out to Jesus for the first time and he met me so profoundly. Yeah, it was like a radical Holy Spirit encounter. And I'd always heard about that happening. I grew up in the church. I never really had a relationship with Jesus. And honestly, I just thought that people were nuts when they would talk about the Holy Spirit, you know, filling you. when that, it knocked me on my butt and I felt so much peace, so much love. And I like heard a voice on the inside. I know it was God now saying like, I got this and I'm going to use your story. And then the timeline after that has just been amazing. I mean, he's got me plugged in with She Found His Grace. I went through the classes and the abortion recovery classes, and they taught me how to share my story, all of the shame that I was living in. I'm able to talk about it more and I'm able to walk in God's forgiveness.
Well, Mackenzie, you have an incredible testimony. Tell us more about how the abortion affected you, both mentally as well as spiritually.
Mentally, my anxiety was all over the place. I was experiencing suicidal thoughts. I remember directly after my first abortion, looking in the mirror, because the pill abortion, you know, you're basically, it's a forced miscarriage into your toilet. And that whole process was, it was 6 hours long. The contractions, the pain was excruciating. But after it was all said and done, I just remember standing up and looking at myself in the mirror and like touching my stomach and just grieving the fact that my child wasn't there anymore. And I remember just not knowing who I was looking at in the mirror. So I think that just sent me spiraling even more. That's when I started numbing out with alcohol. Spiritually, I never really had a relationship with Jesus. So I'm not sure how it spiritually affected me. If anything, it made me pull even further away from him. My idea of God, it was the spirit of religion, pretty much. I had to follow all these rules and I had to gain my way, earn my way to salvation. So it made me pull even further away from him because I never felt like I could be loved by him.
And you found out you didn't have to earn your way, did you?
I broke all 10 of the commandments. Look at that. I broke them all. And he loved me despite all of it.
And on those days when Satan reminds you of your past, as he does all of us, just remind him of his future. And it doesn't look so good.
Amen. Amen.
I'm curious, did you at any point after the first abortion, did you feel any relief at all?
I did. After the first abortion, no. But after the second abortion, and I don't know if it had anything to do with the Roe versus Wade that was going on, and just like the immense amount of pressure that was on me with that second abortion, I did feel relief directly after. Yes.
How long did that last, that feeling of relief?
Very short. It was very short. And then I was disassociating a lot from my emotions and my feelings. And then I started drinking.
Well, obviously, for the second abortion, you had already had the prior experience, but going in for that first time, what did you know about abortion before you entered into the facility?
I knew that it was killing a child. I didn't understand what my child looked like as far as how far along I was. I think I was 8 weeks with the first one and then 10 weeks with the second one. So with the first one, I believed it was killing a baby, but the actual abortion doctor, or I don't even know if they're called doctors, he told me that it was just a clump of cells. And I fed into the lie that it was a clump of cells.
Dr. Ridden, you recently finished a study on abortion comparing grief versus relief. Tell us a little more about your findings.
Yeah, so basically one of the purposes of this study is a random national sample of women, and we asked them to rank the degree to which they experienced various emotions following their abortions. And it's commonly claimed by abortion advocates that relief is the most common reaction to abortion. And we did not find that was true for the majority of women. There was a subset of women, about 30%, who did state that relief was their most strongest reaction. But all those women freely chose their abortions and they were consistent with their own values and preferences. 70% of all women having abortions have some moral conflict, maternal conflict. It's against their values and preferences, but they feel they have no other choice. In fact, our study found that about 25% described their abortions as unwanted or even coerced. So anyway, for that 70% of women, guilt, grief, depression, anxiety, shame were all much more common than relief. It was only the one-third of women, less than one-third, who claimed that relief was their most dominant emotion. Now, even some of them had very severe negative reactions, as Mackenzie was kind of saying. And again, that's part of the problem with even the word relief. Abortion is both a stress reliever and a stress creator. So in the moments following an abortion, you're glad it's over with. I mean, no one looks forward to having an abortion. So just being through the procedure that's done is behind you, whatever pressures you face from other people. In Mackenzie's case, the pressure she fears being dishonorably discharged, whatever, the feeling that, oh, that's over with brings a sense of relief. So that does not mean there's a long-lasting relief in the sense of my life is better, every day is joyous. It is usually a temporary thing. whereas the negative outcomes are lasting and persistent.
Dr. Reardon, you've done a considerable, significant body of work in how abortion affects women and men. Were there any surprises you found with this research?
No, in this particular study, I can't say I was surprised. As I said, the main purpose of this particular study was to try to gather better data on women's emotions after abortion, because we're trying to counter the Planned Parenthood claim that the most prominent feeling from 95% of women is relief, which is just totally bogus. It's based on two studies that were conducted at abortion clinics using non-random sample of women. And we know from several studies, including our own, that the women who anticipate the most negative reactions are the least likely to participate in an abortion clinic study. So if you're not feeling relief, you're not going to agree to answer questions about your abortion. You just don't want to have anything. You know, mm-hmm. The immediate reaction after abortion for most women is, I don't want to think about it. I'm going to try to push it back and go on with my life. And another common reaction is just deep immediate grief and loss, especially if they've been pressured into unwanted abortion and they don't want to talk about it either. So the Turnaway study is a classic example of a study that only 30% of the women who they invited to participate, and that was non-random invitation process already, only 30% even participated in one survey, and then 50% dropped out before the survey was over. Yet they pretend like that their findings can be generalized to the general population. And that's one of the studies where they said that, you know, 95% of women believed that they made the right decision. Even that question was bogus, because the way it was framed was, given your situation, did you make the best decision you could? And they translate that into relief, saying, well, 95% of it, because the women felt it was the best decision, that was relief, which isn't true. So there's all kinds of, you know, the abortion advocates really twist the mm-hmm. data, they twist the findings, they try to make it sound like relief is very common, and most women don't have any issues with their past abortions. And again, with our national random sample of women, we found that's totally wrong, and that relief is not high except for the small minority of women who fit these other criteria.
In your professional opinion, Dr. Reardon, do you think that there's a shred of concern or guilt for pumping out this kind of garbage research as far as its impact on women?
Well, I think it's important for people to understand that it's not just about women's rights, and it's not about just the welfare of women. A lot of people, you know, the other side portrays that this is all about women's freedom to choose, and that the myth that every abortion is freely chosen and benefits women is what they want people to think, but it's not the truth. And when I say they, I'm talking about the people who are interested in abortion as population control and social engineering. The people who, they're really the ones who legalized abortion. We know Margaret Sanger came from eugenicist background, and abortion was a tool to morph from the fit and less from the unfit. And they targeted Black communities with birth control, and Planned Parenthood continues to target low-income people with abortion. We have foundations funding abortions for poor people because we, in part, they don't want poor people to have more children.
And that's right.
It's not about the benefit of the woman. It's about the benefit of society to have fewer people, especially low-income people, people who are at higher risk of poverty and low education and drug abuse or crime or whatever. I mean, there is a lot of prejudice against any young woman who's not in a great situation, educated, married, with a white picket fence. If you don't have all those things, you shouldn't be having a baby in the minds of the social engineers. Ron Weddington, who was the husband of Sarah Weddington, and he was co-counsel in Roe v. Wade. It's very important. People realize he wrote a letter to President Clinton when he was coming into office, advocating the policy that Clinton actually took, which was to secure the rights for RU-46, which is now mifepristone, the abortion pill, and give it to a nonprofit organization to shield it from lawsuits. And precisely in the letter, he describes the need. We need cheap abortions to solve the problem of poverty in America and too many people on Medicare. The letter is blatantly about social engineering. We need cheap abortions to get rid of the poor. And people don't understand that's one reason women are being deceived at abortion clinics. It's one reason the abortion clinics are gladly complicit with coerced abortions. A young girl comes in and says, I don't want to have this abortion. My parents want me to. The abortion clinic gets on the sides of the parents and pushes the girl into that abortion instead of protecting her. So we have a real crisis in America of unwanted, unsafe abortions.
Yeah. And to you, the listener, we're going to post on our website that letter.
Dr. Reardon, it seems worth mentioning to me that trusting Planned Parenthood's claim that all of their customers are happy seems very similar to trusting the cigarette companies back when they used to tell people that cigarettes were safe and healthy.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much the same thing. It is very advocacy driven. Research that's published by abortion advocates is all carefully designed and prepped to present only one side of the story. In fact, we mentioned the Turnaway study. Yeah, so that's a very famous study that they published a lot of data based on these women they interviewed at abortion clinics, and they interviewed women who had first trimester abortions and women who had abortions close to the gestational limit. And then they interviewed a woman that they called in the Turnaway group, the women who did not have abortions because they were beyond the gestational limits of the abortion clinics. Anyway, so there's all kinds of publicity about this study. But very notably, they had findings showing regret, postpartum depression, other things. And these are kind of just small admissions in the papers, but the headlines are always shifted to make it sound like abortion's great. And they do not share their data. Contrary to APA rules for data sharing, and most journals require the data be available for other researchers to verify results, they don't allow their data to be used because they don't want anybody to publicize all the holes in their data. I mean, obviously we know some of the holes because they do publish enough we can point to them, but they don't allow us any direct access to the data so that we can really show the huge gaps in their findings.
So Dr. Reardon, why do you believe it is that those who get abortions end up suffering more grief than relief?
Because they report it. I mean, when you ask women, you know, just like McKinsey, I mean, she had temporary relief, but all kinds of grief, and it's long-lasting grief. In fact, our studies show that the women are more likely to have what's called prolonged grief disorder, okay, which is grief that persists more than a year after a loss. For women who've had abortions, this is what also called disenfranchised grief, because it's not a grief that we can normally talk about with, you know, when a loved one, a husband or a child dies, people know you're going through the grief process, you talk about it. It's something that you can share and you get a social support for. An abortion is something there's no social support for, an abortion grief, okay? I mean, obviously, post-abortion healing community, they're out there trying to make themselves available, but typically, people don't know how to deal with it, abortion grief. In fact, I also point out that normally, a woman who's had an abortion, she's afraid to share her grief with somebody she perceives as pro-life because she's afraid of judgment. She's already judging herself. She doesn't need judgment from somebody who's going to be horrified that she had an abortion. So she's more likely to turn to somebody she sees as a pro-choice friend and say, well, I went through abortion, and you know, I've been feeling kind of blue about it. And that friend's going to try to say something helpful. It's not going to be helpful, but she's going to say, well, it wasn't really a baby yet, or you can have another baby someday, or you did the right thing. All these things that are intended to be comforting, but really say your grief is misplaced and you shouldn't be grieving. So actually getting support for your grief is hard for somebody who's had an abortion because nobody on either side is normally inclined to understand how to provide support. And again, that's why I think it's very important to educate the pro-life community on how we have to be very compassionate. We have to wear our compassion on our sleeve and let people know that even though we think abortion's bad for women and children, obviously, we understand the pressures women face. We understand the grief that follows. We're there to provide support, and we're not there to condemn. We're there to provide healing. And we need to overcome the stereotype in our culture that people who are pro-life are anti-women and judgmental and harsh and hateful people. We need to push against that stereotype, which is the way that the other side tries to keep their game running at the expense of women.
Well, following up on what you just said, what are some of the ways that you'd like to see the pro-life movement achieve that?
First off, always assume when the abortion topic comes up that anybody you talk to may have had an abortion, or certainly may have had loved ones involved in abortion. Because if you try to, you know, pro-lifers go out and ask somebody to put a sign up in their yard, you know, vote pro-life or whatever, you get a lot of pushback. Why? Because maybe somebody's had an abortion or they have a loved one and they like, I don't want to make Susie think that we're condemning her with a pro-life sign up front, you know. So always assume people have some experience with abortion. And what I suggest is that the water fountain or whatever at work, you can say, you know, I heard somebody on the podcast today, and I never before heard, knew, understood how much pressure women face to have an abortion. And then secondly, I've never understood how alienated they feel and how much pain and suffering and grief and how they get no support. And third, but there's good news is there's all these programs out there now for post-abortion healing. And I think that's really great. And I'm going to try to support those. And so saying those three things covers 3 points. First, it conveys, I have new understanding that I had never understood before. So if they perceive you as a religious pro-life zealot, now they see you as somebody who understands women are pressured to have abortion. So they no longer see you as opposed. Secondly, you have empathy for the alienation and hurt and grief that women are facing. And so now you're somebody they could talk to. And third, that you plant a seed of hope that there's programs out there. So you've already, in just 3 little statements, you've shifted somebody's understanding of what the pro-life movement is like and what your own thoughts are. And compare that to the opposite, where a young woman who heard one of my talks, she said to me after, until I heard you talk, I never understood how a woman could have an abortion. She'd lived a good young Christian life, and she was virgin when she got married, and she just had never walked in the shoes of somebody else and to understand it. And so, but if she had said that at the coffee table with a bunch of women, I don't understand how anyone can have an abortion. Mm-hmm. How alienating is that, right? I mean, somebody else is hurting there who she might actually be able to offer a lot of support and love to, because she probably is a loving, she's a loving, compassionate woman, but she, a misstatement like, I don't understand how anybody can have abortion, closes the door to somebody who needs help and healing and good news. So like I said, I think it's important for everybody. I think pro-life politicians should say, I know women in my own family, friends and loved ones who've had abortions and have suffered grief, and I'm here to help them. And this whole abortion debate isn't about judging people. It's about preventing the ongoing abuse and hurt of women. And we just need to, provide healing, and we have to provide better options, something like that. We need to close the perceived gap between women who are hurting from past abortions and men who are hurting from past abortions, mm-hmm. and the perception of the pro-lifers as being condemning, hateful people.
And those feelings, I think, are often in the hearts and minds of pro-lifers. They just need to get it out and let that pro-life fallout, if you will, around them lift people instead of doing the opposite. Dr. Reardon, you've talked about, of course, in detail about grief. What other symptoms or emotion side effects have you witnessed either in your research or in society that women suffer through after an abortion?
Well, it's a whole gamut of things. Obviously, grief is a big one, perhaps one of the most common. And then there's post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. And there's another new diagnosis called moral injury, which is kind of related to post-traumatic stress disorder. But it's fundamentally the experience of having not lived up to your own ideals of what a good person would be. Okay, falling short of participating in something that is morally, that you have own moral condemnation of. The debate is often about, the suggestion that pro-lifers are trying to impose our moral values on women. But the fact is, for 70% of women, abortion is a violation of their own moral values. So it's not about society imposing these values, it's self-violation of their own values. So there's eating disorders, certainly suicidal behaviors, a strong increased risk of suicidal behaviors following abortion. Substance abuse is a major factor. So, every person has their own flaw line, so to speak, in our personalities. And so abortion will find whatever that flaw line is, and it will manifest itself differently in different women. But there is a broad gamut of negative reactions.
Yeah, I think that, as you mentioned, 70% of women who have an abortion, it conflicts with their moral feelings and beliefs. So I think that the term you talked about, moral injury, is something that needs to be common in our vernacular within the pro-life movement. Thank you both for being part of a really important discussion. We really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
Well, Victor, Dave has tons of experience over the years with his research on how abortion impacts women and men. And I found that as I got to know him over the years, that he's got a compassionate heart and passion for women after abortion and the impact it has on them.
Well, and that much is very evident from his work. Hearing his idea on opening the door to these abortion facilities being held accountable for what they do, and seeing the response from the abortion industry, to me, Brad, that's very telling. The fact that they don't want to be held accountable for anything that they do. They can damage these women, they can kill their children, but they don't want to have any of the blame come back on them.
That's right. And in addition to exposing all of this, he's really good at telling us as pro-lifers what we can do to help share with women that we understand them, we're not judgmental, and direct them toward the counseling and relief that is available to every woman who has chosen abortion.
And Mackenzie's testimony is a very powerful testament to that fact, that she was in that position. She knows exactly mm-hmm. how it feels. She knows the pressure that these women have faced, and she knows the lies of the abortion industry, the things that they told her to make her feel more okay with getting this abortion, obviously, so that they can boost their bottom dollar. To you, our listener, I want to encourage you to learn more about this topic by visiting our website, lifeissues.org. There you'll find links to Dr. Reardon's studies. You'll also find links to ways that women can find healing after abortion, and some of the information we discussed regarding Planned Parenthood's faulty predictions of 95%, you can share that information with your friends, your family members, and your church community so that we can help defend life together. Again, that's available at our website, lifeissues.org. And be sure to tune in next week for another Straight Talk on Life Issues.